Suitor number three. What would our first date be like?
Well, first I'd take you shopping to the stores you'd want to shop in. And then we'd do a little lunch, probably at the Cheese House, followed by some golfing. And then at night, we'd take in an opera, probably Die Fledermaus. And then I'd follow it all up with a drive to a secluded beach where I'd pop on the radio and then we could slow dance till the sun came up.
That was the biggest load of crap I've ever heard. I mean, look at you. You're the kind of guy that would beg for sex. And I should know. We can smell our own.
A modern day remake of Matthew Vaughn's Leia kick. A Coen brothers end up with Timothy Chalamet.
A Citizen Kane prequel, a Midnight Cowboy sequel. Alvin and the Chipmunks deserve another squeak.
There's so many new ways to revisit sideways, but a graphic novel is how we choose to update.
But we still hold fast, you can't change the past on the Ruined Childhoods podcast.
Greetings, Starfighters, Pork Rollers, and Taylor Hammers. This is Ruined Childhoods. And this week we are in the Garden State, aka the diner capital of the world. This state may be the fifth smallest in the US, but it is home to the world's tallest water sphere. This state is featured in the television shows The Sopranos, Jersey Shore, and Charles in Charge. But if you're in Japan, those shows are called The Sopranos Mafia of Sorrow, Macaroni Rascals, and, well, Charles in Charge. But most importantly, this is the home state of your hosts. That's us. Dan, how would you best describe your home state pride?
Fist pumps, Bruce, the Jersey, not Jersey Shore, the TV show, because half of those knuckleheads are from Staten Island. How would I describe my Jersey pride?
True.
I by exits 135 through 137, and yeah, no, John, my Jersey pride runs deep. And yours?
I don't think that mine runs very deep. Okay. Haters, ruinedchildhoodspod@gmail.com. It's okay. I feel pretty embarrassed a lot of the time about being from New Jersey.
Sad.
Why? I mean, Sad. That's just kind of the way to, and I think that it is just like, you know, okay, I mentioned the Sopranos, and it's like the vision that a lot of people have of New Jersey is kind of this thuggish mentality. And it's true. Like, I've seen, like, my experience feels, it's not like I've had a lot of experience with the mafia. I'm not going to say.
Not that you would talk about.
What degree, even if it is 0%. But I think that it's just it has a perception of being very bro-y and macho, and I have experienced those kind of things, and I don't like to identify with that type of thing, and I know that that's a generalization, but it is a stereotype for a reason, so I don't know.
But they're from Staten Island. They're from Staten Island.
I'm not talking about the Macaroni Rascals right now. So I'm talking about, like, you know, real people. But also, I think that some of the people on Jersey Shore were from New Jersey.
No,
some of them weren't, but...
Certainly know people who went to high school with, like, at least one of them. I forget which one.
Oh. J-Wow.
It was one of the DJ Pauly D. I feel like maybe this. Yeah, it was either Pauly D or like The Situation. That
Vinny. I think The Situation was a Staten Island.
One of them. One of them was like a South Jersey guy. I should say like a shore area Jersey guy. Yeah, not all the way South Jersey. We're talking about, like, you know, the Manalapan, Marlboro, Central Jersey area. Yeah. And that's the thing. This is, and I know this is true of most states. Honestly, most things that people say about one state tends to be true for most of the rest.
Oh, and it is a very funny thing. And for maybe our international listeners, I don't know if this will resonate. I don't know if like different provinces in Canada have different feelings, you know, the same types of feelings about like the neighboring provinces, but there's
the Saskatchewaners are looking down their noses at the Albertans.
Yeah.
And the Quebecers look down at everybody.
Sure. Yeah. The Montrealans. Yeah. But what I'm thinking specifically about is how every state seems to have an opinion about the neighboring state, whichever one is closer to where they are, being the worst drivers.
Well, so, yeah, but in the case of New Jersey, it's true because Pennsylvanians are the worst drivers.
Oh, it really?
Yes. This is all due respect to Pennsylvania. Again, another, what I was getting at earlier, by the way, was that whereas like New Jersey definitely has like very distinct areas, and this is true for other states, but where like you could be in New Jersey and be, you could be in a car and you could be in Elizabeth, New Jersey, up by Newark Airport, and you know where Tony Soprano drives past, and then you could fall asleep and wake up and be like, when did I end up in West Virginia? And you won't be, you'll be in like Cumberland County, and that's it. But New Jersey is, it's got the Pine Barrens and the shore.
For such a small state, it does have a lot of very interesting, diverse geography. That's for sure. And, you know, in the intro, I started off by mentioning pork roll and Taylor ham, which are the same exact thing, called something different depending on whether you're in the north half or the south half of the state. And it's like there are so many strange differences between the two. And also it's like, you know, Northern Jersey, they have the New York sports teams that they root for, and South Jersey has like the Philadelphia sports teams that they root for. And for such a small state, it really does have such different culture depending on which part of it you're in.
And it's one of those odd states, speaking about sports teams, where even some of the New York sports teams play in New Jersey, because the New York Jets and the New York Giants both play in Jersey. And then the New Jersey Nets moved to Brooklyn, but they're called the Brooklyn Nets now.
Right. And, well, that was just a franchise move.
But worst drivers, the worst drivers, absolutely, for Pennsylvania. And I don't want to get canceled for saying this, but I always used to joke that it was because they had so recently switched over from horse and buggy to automobiles. But I am, of course, only referring to a portion of the state.
Well, perhaps we'll talk some more about that if we cover Witness on our Pennsylvania episode. But anyway, but it's funny because living in Oregon, specifically, you know, the north edge of Oregon, which borders Vancouver, Washington, you know, the stereotype here is that Washington has the worst drivers, and you can always tell a Washington driver. And I've talked to people who live in Wyoming who are just like, Idaho has the worst drivers. And it's just whichever license plate you see that's pissing you off is of course going to be the one that's like the closest state. And I don't know. It's just a funny thing that happens.
I will say, living in Washington state, having lived here now for eight and a half years, I have not, this is not something that I hear in Washington state about neighboring states' drivers. I generally hear how terrible Washington drivers are,
which is funny. And Seattle, I think that might have something to do with the fact that, like, you know, you're not near other borders. I mean, the closest border you have is Canada, and it's not like super close.
Right.
I think that maybe when you're more towards the center of a state or bordering closer to like an ocean, then it's not going to come up as much.
Maybe. But growing up in Jersey and living in Jersey, I firmly believe that the worst drivers in the nation have Pennsylvania license plates. And I don't know necessarily that it's them. I think it might just be the Pennsylvania license plates that do it. And it's funny because I will still be driving around Seattle and there will be some car that I'm like, they're driving like at least 5 miles under the limit. They're in the left lane, but they definitely look like they might just decide to drift over into the right lane at any point. And they've got a Pennsylvania license plate. What are they doing all the way over here?
Okay. I will just say one quick thing. You mentioned going 5 under the speed limit. That's totally okay. The speed limit is what should, I'm not saying is what it usually is, but it's supposed to be the maximum. Now, if there is a road where there's a speed minimum and they're going under the minimum, which I've seen in certain areas, but if there's a minimum, then
You keep up with the rate of traffic. And look, it's just like how getting someplace 5 minutes early is being on time. Keeping within 10 miles of north of the speed limit is sticking to the speed limit.
One more thing about driver, about commenting on drivers from other states is, perhaps it is the only way that we can generalize a group of people for something that is negative in a way that's somewhat acceptable, because it doesn't have anything to do with race or gender. It just has to do with the fact that you have a license plate that looks different from yours.
there's that. I will say this about Seattle drivers, though. Because I like Pennsylvania drivers, I definitely have more experience with in my lifetime, but Washington drivers, particularly Seattle drivers, are not great. And Seattle drivers will admit this, like other Seattle drivers say,
oh yeah,
nobody uses it. Well, especially like the newer drivers, and nobody ever uses their turn signals.
Oh.
And also, for a city that sees so much rain, the people who drive here do not seem to know how to handle it. And but also, once we get like the first really sunny day of the year, forget it. It's like people have never seen the sun before. Like, how do I drive with the giant flaming ball staring me in the face? Yeah, it's and I'm like, okay, I don't get it. Like, how are you? Like, I get, like, in New Jersey, I always used to say, if anything is falling from the sky, the people in New Jersey forget how to drive, and everyone's just, what is this falling? What, water falling from the sky? What is this apocalypse? And here, well, it's like you should be used to that, and they're not. Also, a lot of steep inclines.
Yeah. Well, the Pacific Northwest is a little bit more geographically diverse in that way than where we grew up on the East Coast.
Yeah.
And, and I want to clarify, there are things that I do like about New Jersey, just going back a little bit and bringing it back to New Jersey. And I'd say one of them is that and this came up in the intro, but I think that the diner culture is really cool.
Yes.
And I know that diners are in probably most, if not all, states, but the way that they exist in New Jersey is just a little different.
Every town has a diner.
Has multiple. Everybody has their preference. Everybody has kind of their backup in case the preference doesn't work out. There's opinions about everything. Yeah.
And it depends on what you're going for, too. It depends on the dish. If you want, some disco fries, perhaps, you might go to Diner A. But if you're interested in perhaps a blueberry muffin, you might go to Diner B. Diner B might offer the better blueberry muffins there. If it's some diners, and this is, I will quote our cousin Jeffrey in referencing diners, referencing diner culture. Who once said that it's not a true diner if it is not open 24 hours and owned by Greeks.
Absolutely. The Greek community has figured out the diner.
Yes. Absolutely.
God bless them.
Absolutely. And I totally am with that 100%. A diner is a place where it's at any time of day, you could go in, you can get yourself a cup of coffee. It might be terrible. It doesn't matter. You can get yourself something fried, something baked, something tasty, something that's going to cure what ails you. The diners, it was always big, like after concerts, go to the diner.
Oh yeah.
Or after being a musical theater kid or theater kid in general. But yes, after you all go after rehearsals, reliable, go to the diner and you knew the wait staff. They knew you. And you were, sometimes you got lucky, you got a diner. Sometimes you got a diner with those little jukeboxes on the table.
Oh, isn't that a delight?
I mean, and that's fun to play with.
A couple quick things bouncing off what we were talking about, and I promise we'll get to the movie at some point. But when you mentioned diner coffee. Okay. I consider myself somebody who is very conscious of the coffee that they're drinking. I like really good coffee. I like really good coffee, or I like diner coffee because it's different. It's like there's something, you know, in that like chunky mug that's, you know, been around since the 80s, maybe even longer.
It's got lipstick stains on it.
There's something that's satisfying about that kind of coffee. And I would much rather have diner coffee than like a lot of the chain coffee that's out there. I either want the good stuff or I want the diner stuff. Going back to the Greek thing, there's one diner, I want to say in, maybe this is in Clark, New Jersey, but they have a section on the menu that is called It's All Greek to Me. And that's like the Greek side. And it's just like we're talking about the Greek thing that just popped into my head. And I was like, oh, my God, I love that. I think that diner also has a clock on the wall that says time to eat and neon around it. And
what diner? Because you said Clark and I'm like the Windsor. It's not the Windsor Diner anymore. But once upon a time was the Windsor Diner in Clark.
Yeah, I thought maybe it was the Windsor Diner. I don't know.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Possibly. Well, the clock that's time to eat. There's so many great... I got to run down the list of diners.
Okay. Let's quickly start in our hometown of Cranford, New Jersey.
Yes.
What's your pick?
Rustic Mill.
Of course. The Crustic.
Yes. No. The other, like the Cranford Family Restaurant or whatever it's called now. Okay, fine. Yeah. You know what? It's serviceable. Our, you know, parents... like it, but I'm a Rustic Mill man.
Me too.
Yes. All right. Yeah. So the Cranford we got to. Westfield only has the one diner. Westfield. No. They have Vicky's Diner.
I don't know Vicky's.
So Vicky's Diner in downtown Westfield, New Jersey. We've referenced Westfield on the podcast before, notably in the Addams Family.
The Addams Family episode. Yeah.
Home of Charles Addams. So
not anymore. Unless, no. Although, if anybody was going to come back as a ghost, it'd be Charles Addams.
However, Westfield is the current resting place of Whitney Houston, so it's got that. But
is it?
Yes, Whitney Houston is buried in the cemetery back not far from Temple Emmanuel.
Okay, all right.
It's by the right across from the Greek Orthodox Church. In Westfield.
Got it. Okay.
So, yep. So Westfield has Vicky's Diner, which is more of a like gimmicky. It's not like definitely not like the waiters and waitresses sing 50s diner. More of a, it's got that aesthetic, like the checkerboard aesthetic to it. So there's Vicky Diner and then there's the Westfield Diner, which I have not been to since we visited, and it was in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy that we went in there, and there was like somebody's coleslaw had a worm in it. And that was the last time we went to the Westfield Diner. But
bottle of tequila, bring on the worm. Coleslaw, definitely not.
No, not the time or the place. I'm just going to run down a few of the other great Jersey diners that I have spent time in. So first of all, I want to mention in Linden, New Jersey, there are two diners, at least there were back in the day. So there's like the Linden House Diner, which was on the main drag. And then not too far, like around the corner from it, there was another diner and I forget what
that's
it was
called.
That's
where fudge is made. Go on.
There you go. Yes. But so two great diners in Linden, New Jersey. Then there was the aforementioned Windsor Diner in Clark, the TikTok Diner, which was up in like, I want to say Nutley, or around there up in the Montclair area.
Sure. Yeah.
The TikTok Diner, there was the like Silver Diner that was along Route 46. So many wonderful diners.
I remember going to the Lido Diner.
Oh, the Lido Diner on Route 22. Yes, definitely. Yes, that's been gone for a while now. But I remember having some good times at the Lido Diner.
Pour one out.
Definitely.
Pour some crappy coffee out.
Yeah, pour. Just pour, and you know it's not hot, so pour it wherever you want. It's not going to burn you. But so there was the Lido Diner, and then, the Edison. So there was the Edison Diner on Route 1. That was a common go-to. The common go-to for when I was doing theater at Rutgers University, our go-to was often the Somerset or Scummer Sweat Diner.
Oh, God. Yeah, of course.
Yes. Well, you have the Crustic, and then you've got the Scummer Sweat.
Yeah.
So the Scummer Sweat Diner, there was also in, I want to say Manasquan, the Peter Pank Diner, not Peter Pan, Peter Pank.
Okay.
With a K at the end. This is not some Mandela effect thing where just a lot of people remember there being a K. There was an actual K, the Peter Pank Diner.
Weird.
Yeah. And I think there was also a Peter Pan Diner in Union.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's so many other wonderful diners that I could come back to, but of course my heart belongs to the Rustic Mill, or at least certain arteries that it contributed to the clogging of.
Yeah. Now I haven't been to, what used to be the Windsor Diner, I have been to since, but otherwise, I don't think I've been to any of these since I left New Jersey after graduating high school when I was 18. I pretty much went to college and never came back intentionally. I was just like, I'm ready for something different. And you went to college in New Jersey and you continued to live in the area, including when you were working in New York. You were at some points living in either Jersey City or Union City. And so your knowledge of the New Jersey diner scene certainly surpasses mine.
Oh, wow. I just remembered a couple of others that were in Bloomfield. Oh, man. I wish I could remember the names of them. Like, really great diners.
Well, maybe at the end of the episode, if they come to you, we can revisit this topic. But I want to mention, I want to mention one other thing that I do really like about New Jersey, in addition to the diner scene, the shopping mall scene. Because a shopping mall in New Jersey is the experience is just different than any other place, including places like Mall of America, which was just a few miles from where Mallrats was filmed in Eden Prairie. And but for us in our area of New Jersey, there were really, you know, the three shopping malls. And I will the big three, which when in order of I guess class, you know, there's the Woodbridge Mall, the Menlo Park Mall, and then not the Short Hills Mall, the Mall at Short Hills is the the more upscale one. So that I know we're gonna go deep into malls, but the Menlo Park Mall I feel like was the one that we maybe went to the most. I feel like it may have like been kind of newer.
It was renovated. The Menlo Park Mall, from what I remember of the Menlo Park Mall.
Which gets a shout out in Chasing Amy.
And in Mallrats.
Oh, it gets a shout out in Mallrats also?
Yeah. The Easter Bunny at the Menlo Park Mall was
The Easter Bunny one. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So Menlo Park Mall was, I want to say it was one of those like one floor malls, kind of like more of a strip mall with a roof on it. And I remember the Menlo Park Mall also had like out by the highway, a separate movie theater that was out there.
Well, and I think that's why we went there more than others, is because of the movie theater.
Right. Well, but also when they rebuilt the Menlo Park Mall, it was newer. They had a more impressive food court. They had a Suncoast. Yeah. They had a lot. They had a great arcade. So the Menlo Park Mall had a lot to offer, and it was newer. Yeah. Had a great the multiplex there. It had one of the first multiplexes.
It was a Cineplex Odeon.
Right. Yeah. I remember it must have opened around 93, just because I remember, I don't think I had been to the movies there, but I remember someone talking about seeing Jurassic Park there and how the sound shook the theater. And I saw Jurassic Park at the Cranford Twin Cinema and which did not have the state-of-the-art sound system. I think I may have seen
it at Menlo Park, because I remember going to see Jurassic Park, and I went with, and we've talked about his brother Dave before, but my friend Sam DeVito, who I was really close with at the time, and when we were getting snacks, he got like a large soda, and I was like, I'm gonna get a large soda. Not realizing the consequences that could happen, meaning that I would have to urinate. And I needed to get up and use the bathroom. And I essentially missed the ending. So I got back and the T-Rex is already in there doing its thing or whatever. And I completely missed how that came about. And it wasn't until home video that I was like, oh, okay.
Okay, now I get
it. So that's how that happened. Yeah.
Yes.
But I feel like that wasn't at the like our hometown movie theater. I feel like that was at a multiplex, and if it was at a multiplex, there's a good chance that it was at the Menlo Park Mall.
Yeah. Because I don't think the other multiplexes near us opened up until a couple of years, like the Lowe's Mountainside.
The Lowe's Theater, which was the dirt mall in Mallrats.
That not the Mountainside. That's right, the Lowe's, but the one New Brunswick.
Yeah. But that Lowe's, I feel like, is the one that I ended up going to quite a bit.
In New Brunswick.
Yeah, the one that was at the dirt mall.
Yeah. So, and that one, that I went to a lot during college because it was right down the road.
Yeah.
And I remember that, like, that had stadium seating. I saw the Star Wars reissues there. When they did the special editions and put those out in the theater, I remember seeing those there. I saw a lot of movies.
That's also where I saw those Star Wars movies, because I remember going there and I went with like our brother Scott and some of our friends, and we were and past guest Jeff Rubin, and we went in costume, but not in Star Wars costume. We just went in regular, just whatever costume we wanted to.
Any costume, Freddy Krueger.
But going back to you going to school at Rutgers,
right?
It was when you were living, and you'll hear where I'm going with this. Was the street Stone Street?
I did live on Stone Street for.
Was that the house? Was that the one house? Yeah. So while you were living there, I went to visit you, and with some of your roommates, we popped in VHS tape, and I believe that was my first time seeing Mallrats.
Okay.
I have a very distinct memory of watching Mallrats with some of your roommates, and I think that may have been my first time.
It is entirely likely that I pretty sure I owned a VHS copy of Mallrats. I mean, I did. I'm pretty sure I owned it by that point.
Yeah, well, I mean, if it wasn't yours, I got there somehow. But I know for sure that what I'm sure smelled like sweat and cigarettes. The living room that was right off the entrance of that house.
Yep.
So yeah.
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 What a wonderful way to experience this movie for the first time.
I have fond memories of it because at the time I was in high school and I was, you know, spending a weekend at my older brother's like college shitty house that to me at the time was the most amazing place in the world. And like,
it was the most amazing place in the world.
Yeah. 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 So I think that experience like sticks out of my head very fondly. And you know, it's like high school dude hanging out with a bunch of like college dudes who, you know, it's like their lives seem so different from mine. And kind of just living in that world for a weekend was exciting. And watching Mallrats was a lot of fun because also it's like, at that point, at that point, Kevin Smith movies were, I mean, I don't know if Chasing Amy had come out yet at the time when you were living there, 97 is Chasing Amy.
Yeah.
So that would have been pretty recently. And so I was just starting to get into Kevin Smith movies, which I ended up getting really into, and revisiting a lot of them this past week has, I have a different perspective and I kind of see them in a different way. Some in good ways, some in not so good ways, but Mallrats, I feel, is a really fun one to be talking about on this episode, especially more so than something like Clerks, because I feel like Clerks 2 and Clerks 3 and Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back.
Clerks the animated
series. They have to become part of the conversation, whereas Mallrats is like, you know, it's his first movie that's remotely connected to a studio, you know, Gramercy Pictures owned by Universal. And it's this, you know, this guy who just like for nothing made a movie and suddenly is given opportunities and working with Shannon Doherty from 90210. And you got Michael Rooker in there and it's exciting.
Yeah. Like real actors, not just like people from, you know, Atlantic Highlands, New Jersey.
Yeah. But, you know, they get folded in where need be.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, one of the things I appreciate about Kevin Smith is that, like, there are certain of his regulars that have just stayed with him. And, like, Brian O'Halloran is, you know, probably, you know, one that he pops up everywhere. And he was Dante in Clerks.
Yeah. Walt Flanagan, Brian Johnson, there are other ones who come in a lot. Brian Johnson is Steve Dave. Right. Walt Flanagan is the guy who says, "Tell him Steve Dave," in like every single Kevin Smith movie. And is also the inspiration for the character of Brody in Mallrats. And also it's like, this is maybe the first movie where there's like a Stan Lee cameo. And it just like, it becomes part of Marvel history in a weird way.
Well, and that's and I know we've got to get to the synopsis here, but that's something that came up in an interview that Kevin Smith did with Entertainment Weekly about how the movie was initially received and how Jay Jax, one of the producers, said it was too soon. We were too soon with it.
Sure.
And for Kevin Smith, looking at that in hindsight and taking that as he wrote Mallrats for, as somebody whose world kind of revolves around comic books and who was passionate about that and like knew, like in Kevin Smith's world, everyone knows who Stan Lee is. But in the world of 1995, outside of that, you know, cult following, and there was no internet to really like, you know, unite the, you know, fans, yeah, comic book fans, it wasn't a big thing. And like he makes the point of how like Brody has to explain when Jay starts doing like Wolverine's thing.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
he's like, you wouldn't have to explain that today. Everybody knows.
Not at all. Yeah. And I mean, it's possible that Mallrats is how I really learned who Stan Lee was, because I wasn't like a comic book kid.
Or at least what he looked like and sounded like. Like
certainly,
you might have
yeah
seen his name on a comic book, but never oh really thought.
But not thinking about it. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No. Yeah.
So why don't I do a brief synopsis and then we'll really get into this?
Yeah. Fire it up.
Two recently broken up with 20-somethings try to pick up the pieces of their failed relationships by going to the only place that brings them joy, the Eden Prairie Mall. It's there that T.S. Quint discovers that his ex-girlfriend's father's dating game ripoff show is filming there later in the day, and just so happens to be featuring his ex, Brandy. T.S. decides that the only way to win back Brandy is to infiltrate the set and confront his would-be fiancé. Meanwhile, T.S.'s pal Brody Bruce discovers that his ex-girlfriend Renee is now seeing Shannon Hamilton, the owner and proprietor of men's boutique Fashionable Male. As it turns out, Shannon has already introduced Renee to his mother, a major point of contention in Brody and Renee's relationship. Brody and T.S. enlist the help of fellow Mallrats Jay and Silent Bob, plus a teenage sex writer named Trisha, to help them sabotage Brandy's dad's show so T.S. can prove his devotion to Brandy and Brody can upstage and humiliate Shannon in front of Renee. So Shannon Doherty plays Renee. This is the thing that she has claimed kind of ended her film career. We'll get to that in a little bit. Jeremy, not Jason London, plays T.S. Right. Jason Lee is Brody, and this is his real first acting role. He, aside from a quick like extra bit that he did, and
Airborne,
man,
does
he...
right?
No,
was he one? He wasn't in Airborne. He
wasn't no
one of the skaters. No,
seems like he would have been, but no.
Yeah. Okay,
right. I forget what it is. Claire Forlani is Brandy Svenning. Ben Affleck is Shannon Hamilton. Joey Lauren Adams is Gwen. Renee Humphrey is Trisha. Jason Mewes, Jay. Kevin Smith, Silent Bob. Ethan Suplee is Willem. Stanley. Priscilla Barnes as Miss Ivana. Yes. Michael Rooker as Jared Svenning. Svenel Thorson as LaForge. Scott Mosier, who's also a producer, as Roddy. Just an incredible cast. The aforementioned Brian O'Halloran as Gil Hicks, canonically cousin to Dante Hicks. Canonically cousin to whichever the Hicks is that's in Dogma, who's the like newscaster.
Okay. Yeah. It's been a while since I've seen Dogma.
I watched Dogma the other day. So Mallrats, you know, even though Clerks came first, Mallrats establishes that the connected universe.
Yes.
You know, we hear at the very beginning Brody talking about his cousin Walt, and we kind of made the connection that Brody's character is like cousins with, oh, and I'm blanking on the character's name from Clerks, that
Randall,
Randall, who works at the video store. So like they're like everybody is connected somehow, you know. There's the girl who died at the YMCA swimming
right
pool,
Julie Dwyer,
Julie Dwyer, who's mentioned in Clerks, who
yep.
So in the Mallrats,
Willem, Ethan Suplee's character is a character in Clerks.
Yeah, different
I'm
actor,
assuming it's
but
the same Willem.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, in the Mallrats
Snowball
commentary. Yes, in the Mallrats we'll get to that in a minute. In the Mallrats commentary, it's established that Mallrats takes place the day before Clerks, which makes sense when you kind of put the pieces together of the shared stories that are kind of told.
Mm-hmm. The day before yeah Clerks.
Yeah. And then Dante's girlfriend in Clerks is sisters with Alyssa from Chasing Amy. And it's just like who, and then Trisha is also, related. No. The girlfriend in Clerks is their cousin.
Wait, Trisha Jones and Alyssa Jones, because Alyssa yes. Jones is chasing Amy.
They're sisters. You see them in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back coming out of the movie premiere.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yes.
It's complicated. And I don't know, like, of course this predates like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and you know, they call it the View Askew Universe. Like, this is really the first like real cinematic universe. And it's just tied to this one filmmaker, Kevin Smith.
And New Jersey.
And New Jersey, which, I mean, not all New Jersey movies are Kevin Smith, but all Kevin Smith movies are New Jersey.
Yes. I mean,
if we're going to square rectangle it.
I don't know if we could say that for Cop Out. And I know Zach and Miri Make a Porno was shot in Pittsburgh. I don't know if it was supposed to be set in Jersey.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. You know, because I don't know if those are, or like Tusk, I don't know if those are supposed to be part of the shared universe.
I don't think so. I mean, Red State certainly isn't.
Right. That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kevin Smith. Yeah. He definitely went off and made some interesting choices outside of his Jay and Silent Bob world.
Yeah, which I think I feel like he kind of eventually just settled into it and was like, this is where I'm good. This is where I'm comfortable. And
yeah, he did Jay and Silent Bob Reboot, which was interesting.
Yeah, I found it entertaining.
Featuring Keith Coogan, past guest on the show.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yes, indeed. But yeah, no, Jay and Silent Bob Reboot. I thought Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, I saw that twice in the theater. I watched it
the other day. It's funny. One of the things that comes up a lot in Mallrats, that comes up a lot in a lot of his movies, and of course it speaks to the time, but there's definitely a big element of like gay panic. That rears its ugly head. Of course, there's use of the R word, yes. Which is, you know, another kind of sign of the times where it's just not considered at all. And it's unfortunate.
It's sign of the times. Also, is it? It also kind of does fit into the characterization of a lot of these characters who don't all seem to have like levels of ambition. In fact, Shannon Doherty in this kind of has that whole speech about it ends with like, and I have nothing better to do than fuck you.
Right. Yeah. She has some great monologues in this movie.
Well, that monologue that she gives, and it's like the situation here is she's sneaking out of the house because Brody's afraid of his mother finding out that he's dating her for some reason. And so she sneaks, she has this whole routine that she's got it down so pat that she gives this like emotional speech about how dissatisfied she is while she's doing this whole routine. And I actually felt like that was maybe one of the more, especially watching it now with a little more maturity in hindsight, I see that as one of those moments in the movie that shows the potential for more. And that like, it's kind of like Kevin Smith, you're onto something here. You're not quite there, but you're getting past the, you know, like dude humor and getting into something real.
He's surprisingly good at writing female characters. And I think that in certain cases, it's that stronger than him writing for men. And I think that also another common theme that runs throughout a lot of his movies is that, and I think that maybe with the exception of like the character of Jay, everybody seems to speak as if they are reciting written words. You know, the vocabulary and the syntax they use is almost all too calculated. What are you wincing about?
Oh, I think that this, that Mallrats is the movie that exposes that more than any other Kevin Smith movie. It's where you really see who is met. Because I feel like Jason Lee jumps in and knows how to deliver Kevin Smith's dialogue and knows how to do it. Whereas Jeremy London and Claire Forlani, among others, not so
Claire
much.
Claire Forlani, who's fighting to hide her British accent.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think that Mallrats and Chasing Amy both. And in Chasing Amy, I feel like some of the biggest offenders are Ben Affleck and Joey Lauren Adams. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when they're having conversations with each other, it's like they're reciting lines off a page. Whereas Jason Lee and Kevin Smith has certainly met his like true voice with Jason Lee. Definitely feels more appropriate. And I feel like that's also because Jason Lee doesn't ever feel like his characters never feel like real people.
I mean,
so it works.
I don't know if I
do. It's not a complaint. It's not a complaint.
Yeah, no. They just, you know, and Jason Lee, like when Ryan Reynolds first became popular, I was like, oh, it's Jason Lee with muscles.
Oh.
Like, because it was the same dry tone.
I would say more like Jason Lee with frosted tips at the beginning. Okay. He was more like, he was less muscular, more frosted tippy in like Two Guys, a Girl, and a Pizza Place.
Oh, yeah. I guess at that point. I mean, I'm thinking of like Waiting era Ryan Reynolds. He did that same thing that Jason Lee does very well with line delivery. I don't know how to describe it.
Jason Lee also, and there's just got to be some sort of like magic in his blood that makes him just instantly good at acting in a Kevin Smith movie, where it's like he also acts with his whole body in a really natural way. Like he's a really good like hand actor. Like you feel like he has complete control over like every single joint to make it express the, like, I don't know, there's something
the game show scene when he gives the answer about like the noises he'd make while making whoopee, and he does that thing with his hands, and then he just says, no, I can't answer that, it's too personal.
He makes the movie really sing, whereas Jeremy London maybe holds it back a little bit. And so to have the two of them together, you know, balances things out. And even though he was quite a liability going into the movie, you know, Jason Mewes is so much fun to watch. I understand that, you know, working with somebody like Jason Mewes, who has been an addict for such a long time and has struggled during a lot of these movies. I don't know if he's clean now. But during
From
so
what
many
I've
of these movies,
heard he is,
which is great because I know that he struggled a lot and was constantly under, you know, cautious eye of like Kevin Smith and, you know, was always in danger of, you know, just ruining everything.
Yeah. And, getting fired.
Well, I mean, on this one, they were ready to replace him at any moment.
Before he was even cast, they didn't want him.
Yeah, they had Seth Green on speed dial.
Seth Green and Breckenmeyer.
Breckenmeyer, yeah. Yeah, and I don't think that Breckenmeyer could do a J. I feel like...
That's got to be purely based off Clueless.
Probably.
Breckenmeyer's stoner character in Clueless.
But I feel like even though, like, of course, Jason Mewes, you know, addicts.
He is. Yeah.
But he's not a stoner in the same way that Breckenmeyer played a stoner.
No, but also like Jay is Jason Mewes.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, he absolutely is.
Which is not necessarily a reason to cast somebody, but nobody else can do that.
Well, he's so magnetic. He's so charismatic. He pops off the screen when you first meet him in Mallrats, and he's like at the pet store window and he's kind of like doing this movement and this dance, It's like, it's perfect. And he, the way that he delivers his lines and speaks this very specific way that he speaks is, it's in his DNA, and it's so different from anybody else in the universe. And it's exactly what a movie like this needs, is that guy who hangs out at the mall, who's selling pot to kids or whatever, and I don't know, just like ready to start trouble just because there's trouble to start.
Well, and it kind of feels like there were those, like there were those guys that would hang around at, like, yeah, you know, hang around at the mall or whatever and just wait for something to happen.
Oh, yeah. I'm Dan, did you do a lot of mall hangs when you were around that age?
Yeah, so going to the mall, when you first get your driver's license, it's like, it's kind of like the destination to go to. Like, oh, where am I going to drive? Well, okay, I'm going to drive to the mall. That's big. It's distance, and I can go, and I'm going to go with my friends and be independent.
Yeah.
So I think there were a lot of trips to the Menlo Park Mall. Yeah. A lot of trips to the Menlo Park Mall during those, you know, mid to late 90s years. Definitely spent a lot of time, you know, used to go to the movies even before I was learned how to drive, just going there, going to the movies, doing stuff, hanging out. So a lot of mall time. Yeah. Did you frequent the mall? Was that?
Yeah. There were definitely a lot of times, I think more in junior high, where, you know, I would get dropped off and like there'd be one kid's parent who was somewhere nearby, but the rest of us just kind of ran amok, and you know, I had $20 and that got me what I needed to get and get a, yeah, Cinnabon and whatever and, yeah, and have a merry old time. Yeah, I don't know if I did as much in like further into high school, but I don't know. The mall was just kind of like a reliable fixture. And I feel like after watching Mallrats, my interest in the hanging out at the mall maybe increased a little bit. Not that I was expecting there to be like some sort of dating game-esque TV show being filmed and or like anything like that. But no, not exactly. And I not like I ever saw like Tiffany perform or anything like that. But yeah. It certainly was an interesting place. I feel like there were different like opportunities to meet like people. I think that I think this might have been at the mall.
Meet and greets.
Right. I think this was at a mall and where I got the autographs of Mark Summers and some of the Double Dare like on-air personalities.
Yes, definitely.
I got their autograph, and I think that was a mall. And I later went on to work for Mark Summers on a TV show when I was a bit older. So there you go.
And he remembered you from the mall, obviously.
He was like, "Hey, you're that mall kid," and I was like, "That's me. What do you want to do about it?"
No, mall, a lot of good time spent in the mall.
I think I may have even seen Kevin Smith at the mall once, and it was just like off standing somewhere doing something, I think that he was even wearing kind of like a long dark coat, so he looked especially Silent Bob-ish, and it was just kind of like a clocking it situation where it's like, I'm pretty sure that's him. Anyway, moving on.
Did you ever get to, have you ever been to one of his like screenings and Q&As?
No, I know he has the Smodcastle Theater right now, which he does Q&As for movies that he wasn't involved with it, which I think is really funny.
Oh yeah, because it's his theater and he can do what he wants.
He can do whatever he wants, yeah. I'd never been to Jay and Silent Bob's Secret Stash.
I went once. It's in Red Bank, so it wasn't always the easiest place to get to. But yeah, I remember I went once, just like, you know, take a look, check it out. And that was
just
that
to
was
say
cool.
I've been there. Yeah.
Yeah. I did see a screening that he hosted of Chasing Amy.
Oh, so, yeah.
Yeah. And this was sometime in like 98, I think. And it was in Hoboken. He did like a Q&A afterwards. And I remember a lot about, I remember hearing him. What stands out to me was his account of pitching his Superman movie.
Right.
At yeah. Warner Brothers, and having the executive stop him continuously and ask him who Kal-El is.
Huh. Okay.
Right. So, weird. And he was talking about because like this executive wouldn't read treatments. You'd have to go in and read it to him.
What?
And in the okay. treatment, like Kevin Smith was using Kal-El instead of Superman. He kept having to explain who Kal-El.
The movie industry is so strange and makes no sense. And we'll talk about that in a minute. One thing that you mentioned earlier that I wanted to just touch on really quickly, we were talking about the character of Willem, and you mm-hmm. mentioned the word snowball. If you are familiar with Clerks, you know what that means. You also know the significance of the number 37, which appears in a lot of Kevin Smith movies. I remember because, you know, like our brother Scott and I, like we were in this band, so we played a whole bunch. There were two different bands called Snowball 37. There were two different bands. They both stuck with that name, even though they were probably playing a lot of the same. There were two bands called Snowball 37. Yep. But that's how Kevin Smithy, that part of the world is.
Jersey in the 90s.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, John, I meant to share earlier, you brought up the Dirt Mall, the yeah. US 1 flea market, which mm-hmm. was demolished. I was trying to look up the date and I couldn't find the date, but it must have been demolished after fall 1995 because that was the one and only time I was there. So I actually okay. did go to the Dirt Mall. When I was in college, I might have gone there prior to that, but like I remember going at least once, going in there with like mm-hmm. other friends from college, going right. in there once, and then it was demolished and they turned it into the Route One movie theater.
Yeah,
where I saw the so many wonderful movies.
Sure. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And in Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle, they inaccurately describe one of the White Castle locations as being by that movie theater. It's not true.
Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle, and I was thinking of mentioning White Castle as one of the things that I like about New Jersey, even though it's not New Jersey exclusive. It is right. very prominent New Jersey, and Harold yeah. and Kumar just cemented that into lore. Yeah, Harold and Kumar, I think that there was a lot of the geography that doesn't quite check out.
The in Jersey that movie. Geography is terrible in that movie. They're getting like from Hoboken to Princeton, and like it's all happening really quickly. And then they like the most accurate depiction of New Jersey in that movie is how difficult it is to park in Hoboken.
Oh.
Yeah. So
fair enough.
But that's Harold and Kumar. Though something, you know what, is kind of similarly disjointed in Mallrats. Some of the scenes, there are so many things that just don't make sense. That
in Mallrats?
Right. Like that T.S. doesn't know that like his girlfriend's father's game show is going to be at the mall. Or like sure. Brody doesn't yeah. know this. Brody goes to the mall all the time and he has no idea that they're planning on doing like a television broadcast
yeah.
from the mall. There's a lot of just these little inaccuracies, like how also Trish talks about how Shannon like hates Brody and wants to beat him up. But then when they run into him coming into the mall, Shannon doesn't even acknowledge him.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's not a perfect movie. I know that And I don't know if this, you know, answers anything about, especially the first part, but have you ever seen the original, you know, scene that opens the movie?
The one with the governor's mansion.
Yeah, the governor's ball.
Long time ago.
Thing. Yeah. So I wonder if anything gets clarified there, because I don't know if like the production comes together quickly because they get the funding from the governor. Basically, they had this whole other beginning, but it meant that the mall, they didn't get to the mall for like until like an hour into the movie. So they reshot a bunch of stuff and edited a bunch of things out.
Yeah, I forget what it is. Svenning has some major mishap.
Well, Svenning doesn't really have the mishap. It's that TS, there's some sort of like Revolutionary War reenactment thing. It's really strange and doesn't make sense. And TS is part of it and is up on the roof of the building where Brandy, who I guess is studying astronomy and is like looking through a telescope into the sky, and TS is like, you know, bothering her or whatever, and they get into an argument up there, and she was just like, oh yeah, by the way, I'm helping my dad out with this thing. I can't go on this trip to Florida with you. And he has like a musket that for some reason is a real loaded musket. Like, it doesn't make any sense. And so there's some sort of mishap where Brandy's hair gets caught like in the trigger, and they shoot, and it like goes toward the mayor or the governor, and who's talking to Jared Svenning at the time. Brilliantly played by Michael Rooker. And so it explains, and so he loses the funding that he's supposed to be getting, and it explains why he hates TS so much. Uh-huh. But, and there are like some little references that I guess they couldn't cut around, you know, certain things.
They reference the governor's ball.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really weird. I think that the way that they opened it was smart. It works. You get the story of, you know, cousin mm-hmm. Walter, and the, you know, we just kind of get to it.
All that. Yeah. We don't need to get into the details there, but yeah, it picks up and, but right from the first line delivery that TS has, it's just terrible. Brandy's, come on, Dad.
Yeah. Oh, geez. Yeah.
Yeah. But Joey Lauren Adams, though, I would say, like, there's a couple of lines where it's very much like you're speaking recited dialogue, but I feel like she fits into that groove much more smoothly than others. Renee Humphreys doesn't, like, she has lines that are very, it's like, men are easily amused.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, whatever.
I mean, like, it's Mallrats. It's not, it's like, Mallrats. Like, this wasn't put out in December for awards contention. Like,
no. And I'm glad that, though, it has, you know, gained this like cult status and a life of its own that they certainly didn't see coming, including the studios. And, you know, this movie just got totally buried and just shit on. And the life that it's had since its release has been really fascinating and kind of special. And there were a few things as I was watching it that I think just kind of tickled me a little bit. There's something that was very similar, and granted they came out the exact same year, but a very similar moment that happens in Mallrats that also kind of happens in To Die For. And that is a woman trying on underwear in front of their friend. Mm-hmm. Very different vibes and different intentions going on with those two scenes, but
To Die For hadn't hit theaters just 2 weeks before Mallrats,
was it only 2 weeks?
It was only 2 weeks.
Oh my god!
Yes, but I remember. But also, it's like it was close, but.
But also, it's like, how many other movies are there of somebody like probably at a mall like trying on underwear in front of like their friend?
You know how it is, John. These things happen. They come out in pairs, you know, for you get your like father, like son and big. Yeah. and you get your two Lombada movies, and so you have to have two movies where someone's
Deep Impact
trying
Armageddon. In front.
Exactly. Yeah. You get it.
Also, you have to appreciate that in the opening credits, which are you know, the characters as unlike comic book covers, you have to appreciate that Ben Affleck is Buttman.
Yep.
Who would have known that he would have gone on to play Batman?
Yep. Nope. Absolutely. I'm pretty sure around the time that he was cast as Batman, I think I found like a still of that and posted it online. Oh. remembered that. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things about this movie that you're like, man,
prophetic.
Kevin Smith was a bit of ahead of his time in many ways. And in many ways,
no,
not as much.
Sure, yeah, but it doesn't change the fact that like this movie has its own special style to it that you just don't see in other movies, including his own movies.
And while we're talking about that style, let's give a shout out here to Ira Newborn, the master of comedic scores,
brain donors,
indeed, who's able to get the. Take the music and make it match whatever it is they're trying to do in the scene, and throws in lots of references to older scores, but really hits the tone right. So he did the Naked Gun movies as well. So like unsung hero here of comedy cinema is Ira Newborn.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Dan, before we, and I realize we're already over an hour into this, before we move on to kind of what we would do to revisit Mallrats, one thing I want to shout out is that here in Portland, Oregon, there is a mall, the Lloyd Center, that is a... It's being torn down and rebuilt into something else. And right now, a lot of it's very vacant. It's actually kind of famous for having an ice skating rink inside of it, a year-round ice skating rink, which is where Tonya Harding used to practice. So that's a thing. And so one of the things that's really cool about the Lloyd Center Mall now is that because there are so many vacant storefronts, there's a lot of really cool pop-ups in there. So it's presenting opportunities for like really fringy businesses to kind of have little storefronts and things. And it's, you know, it's not going to be your like fashionable male type places. It's really just like weird. Like one of the places that I saw was like a kind of like a Sears portrait studio, but intentionally like, you know, it's like a very good photographer that has a lot of like really funky like backdrops and props and stuff like that. And actually I went to a past guest Brian Box Brown was doing a little pop-up thing with a bunch of other different independent comic book artists and graphic novelists. And I saw him there. There's like in the hallways, there's like baseball card shows and stuff like that. There's actually an organization called Mallrats that is all about doing pop-ups in the Lloyd Center Mall. So it's the legacy of this movie kind of lives on in that name as well, because I don't know if that terminology is really used without the context of the movie. I don't know if that's...
I feel like it was used before the
I mean,
movie,
it had to have been used.
Since.
It had to have been used at least a little bit, but it's like any time since after 1995, it's at least a nod to the movie, right?
One would imagine. I'm looking at... Oh, there's a recording artist, Australian recording artist, whose name is Mallrat.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I don't think there's any direct connection there.
Yeah. So after this movie came out, at a certain point, there was a concept for a Mallrats 2 that, according to Kevin Smith, Universal wanted to do. That was called Mallrats 2: Die Hard in a Mall. Like that was the name of it, and that kind of fizzled away.
See, that's funny because the Mallrats 2 that I read, the
there's another.
No, well, the first one was going to, I read about, was going to be Mallbrats.
Oh, I didn't know about that one.
Well, that was, okay, so that was as, maybe that wasn't the first one because that was as of, I think, 2005.
Okay.
Was going to be Mallbrats.
So this came up in the DVD commentary, which I believe was done in 99. Mm-hmm. So he had already done like Chasing Amy and Dogma, I think he had just done.
Dogma comes out in like October 99.
Yeah, so I think that it was either about to come out or had come out or something. So, and the DVD commentary, I mean, it's great. It's Kevin Smith, Jason Mewes, who's waning in and out of consciousness, Scott Mosier, Ben Affleck, and Jason Lee. And it's really funny. And of course, you know, this is, of course, it's post Good Will Hunting Ben Affleck, but like, he still doesn't seem like a big movie star, even though he's like, I mean, he's done
Armageddon.
Post Armageddon, like he's done these major things, but like he still is just kind of like a guy who's doing the Mallrats commentary and laughing about being in Phantoms, like stuff like that. And
Affleck was the bomb in Phantoms.
Yeah, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. So that came up in that commentary, and perhaps the Mallrats thing at a certain point. So. This has been something that's been coming up a lot on the, like, different news aggregators, but there is a script for something called Twilight of the Mallrats. Mm-hmm. And some of the articles that I saw were just like, Universal's all about doing it or whatever. And in February, which all of these articles predate, but in February, he was on Shannon Doherty's podcast called Let's Be Clear. And it's a great two-parter episode. And she essentially is singing Mallrats praises and speaking very highly of her experience on it and saying, yeah, there were times when I may have said things that made it seem like I was blaming this movie for ending my career, but that's not how I really felt. And things got blown out of proportion or whatever. And they talk about the way that a Mallrats sequel could happen. And Kevin Smith essentially is saying, like, really the only way that it could happen is if Universal Pictures, which owns Gramercy Pictures, so Universal owns the rights to Mallrats. If they want to do it, then it'll happen. But in order for that to happen, it's kind of just like it would take a miracle almost.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Kevin Smith and Shannon Doherty read the first scene of Twilight of the Mallrats.
Oh.
So Twilight of the Mallrats takes place, you know, present day. In this world, Renee and Brody have been married. They had the experience where he was the host of The Tonight Show. She was the band leader, as it says in the end credits of this.
Great.
They have a daughter, and her name is Banner. You know, his last name is Bruce. So it's like Banner. You know?
Yes.
And at this point, Renee and Brody are divorced. And it essentially starts off the same way that their characters start off in Mallrats, with her like coming to his house and, you know, knocking on his head to wake him up. And he's got all the same posters on the wall and probably playing video hockey, perhaps a more recent version. And I can't remember like the specifics of it, but there's of course another big Renee monologue and all that kind of stuff. So who knows? We may see Twilight of the Mallrats, but
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, my initial thought is like, why? And even like, I would rather see Kevin Smith work on other things. But then again, I felt the same way around Clerks 2, and I really enjoyed Clerks 2.
I don't remember much about Clerks 2. That's one that I haven't revisited.
I remember it was really, like, really wacky.
I haven't seen Clerks 3 either.
I have not seen Clerks 3. I just, I get to the point where I'm like, I don't want to go there again. Though I did watch the Jay and Silent Bob reboot. I think that was like a pandemic thing that was
something like that. We talked about it.
Streaming and I thought it was interesting. Thought it was fun.
But yeah,
I haven't gone back to watch a lot of the Kevin Smith movies. I'm most curious to go back and rewatch Dogma.
I watched it, was it yesterday, a couple days ago. It is notoriously hard to track down. That has a lot to do with the Weinsteins.
Yes.
DVD copies are worth a lot. Although I just heard that they're going to be coming out with a new Blu-ray of it, which is going to devalue those DVDs. So if you've got a DVD, sell it now.
I did have it on DVD. I don't have it on DVD.
Oh, that's too bad.
It is too bad.
Yeah, Dogma, it's very specific. It's very, of its time. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I feel like a lot of his better movies are of the, because I think about ones like Cop Out and that just was So anyway, anything else that you want to add about the movie before we delve into our possible futures of it?
Despite its flaws, I have a lot of fondness for it. That's all I can really say.
Likewise. Yeah. Likewise.
Yeah.
Have a lot of, for everything I don't like about it, there's something else that I do like that just takes it to, you mentioned Michael Rooker before. Rooker is wonderful.
So this is interesting about, Michael Rooker. I mean, first of all, we love Michael Rooker. He's continued on to have such a great career in the Marvel universe.
Yes. And
there are two different versions that I've heard Kevin Smith say about the character of Jared Svenning, and it's about how he initially wanted William Atherton to play the role.
Right.
And I've heard him speak about it and saying there are two different reasons why Michael Rooker didn't want to do it. By William Atherton didn't want to do it. One of them being that he didn't want to play the bad guy. The same way, Die Hard and Ghostbusters, and especially because in Ghostbusters, which wasn't a children's movie, but children, including myself, saw it at very young ages. But children would see him on the street and tell him that he has no dick.
I heard that.
Yeah.
Yes.
There was some other reason why he was saying that William Atherton didn't want to do it, but I like the other one. I like that one better.
Right. Yeah. No. That works. That one works just fine.
Yeah.
But look, it's great. William Atherton would have been fun. Michael Rooker, I think, plays it up in a way that is appropriate for the film.
He's very over the top. He's cartoonish.
Yes.
He is a cartoon villain that's just emoting so hard and heavy breathing. And the other thing that's come up recently in the news about Mallrats is how the in the wake of COVID, the idea of the stink palm is something that he never would have done if COVID, if there was a pandemic before then. The idea of that is just absolutely repulsive.
It's repulsive even more so, regardless.
Even more so.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. That is just, if anything, spotlighted the unsanitary nature of a stink palm, COVID would be
God. It. Yeah. Dan, what would you do to revisit Mallrats?
What would I do to revisit Mallrats? John, I thought about this and so many different possible outside of the box ideas, like a VR shopping experience at Buy Me Toys and all of the wonderful shops in the Mallrats universe.
Yeah.
And they're really where I landed on this was maybe a recut version, a recut that kind of smooths out some of the rougher edges, maybe put some of that context back in about the governor's ball. It gives it like just kind of fills it because it's those logic gaps that bug me. And like the first meeting between Mr. Svenning and T.S. play like the second meeting between them plays like the first, like it should be the first meeting. So and of course, I'm not the one to recut it, but I would really love to see some type of director's cut or just a re-edit of this movie that, you know, puts a little more focus on the luster and takes some of the focus away from the its lesser qualities. Maybe trim down some of the T.S. and Brandy scenes.
Well, and it does kind of put them as being kind of the main storyline, and where the Brody Renee storyline is a lot stronger. But because the set piece of the game show really sets Brandy up as being at a higher level, I think that kind of throws off the balance a little bit.
Yeah. And I will say, though, also before we move on, that and I don't know if this is accurate, but the reference to the Menlo Park Mall would lead me to believe so, that this was written to take place at the Woodbridge Mall.
Oh.
Which was another
Town Center, is that right? Yeah,
which was the mall that we frequented before Menlo Park was built. We would go to Woodbridge and then we would go to Short Hills, you know, only on special.
The mall at Short Hills.
The mall.
Go to the Neiman Marcus.
The shops, S-H-O-P-P-E-S.
Yeah, my God.
No, you get valet parking there.
Oh, jeez.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I didn't like the Menlo Park. I didn't like the Short Hills Mall as much because it didn't have a food court.
Right.
And it was like lacking in toys.
Yeah, it wasn't for children.
I believe they had a music. I believe they had a Tape World.
In terms of
their music stores, Tape World. If I remember correctly, I got my cassette copies of Paula Abdul's "Forever Your Girl" and the B-52's "Cosmic Thing"
at
the Tape World in the Short Hills Mall. I think I had a gift certificate.
Okay,
if I remember correctly,
I feel like Menlo probably had like a Sam Goody.
Menlo, Menlo definitely had. Menlo also had the Wiz. Nobody beats the Wiz.
Did Menlo have a Wiz?
It was external. It was. I was on the campus. It was on the Menlo Park campus. But it was
yesterday Googled "Nobody Beats the Wiz," which is now owned by PC Richard and Son. It still exists like by name, kind of in a weird way. Like the words exist on the PC Richard and Son website, which is a regional, Best Buy type of place. But the Nobody Beats the Wiz on Route 22 that was shaped like a giant ship.
It was in a boat. Yes.
That's where I bought my first CD player. And my first CD, Hootie and the Blowfish Cracked Rear View.
Oh, yeah. Only want to be where new.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Going through the newspaper and seeing kind of the like insert for Nobody Beats the Wiz was always such a thrill.
Yep. What deals were they going to have? Yeah, no, I got a lot of good shit at Nobody Beats the Wiz. But yeah, and the Menlo Park Mall had their standalone Nobody Beats the Wiz. Like you had to, you had to drive around to it. Like that was, it was a sub trip if you were going to the Menlo Park Mall. But yeah, they must have had a Sam Goody.
What a brilliantly named store, the Wiz, and what a great slogan that turned out not to be accurate.
And I always thought it was inspired by the musical.
I don't think that I was aware of the musical.
Like I'm pretty sure there's a song in the Wiz where they're like, nobody beats a Wiz, nobody beats a Wiz.
Oh, really?
Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Sometimes my brain just makes things up to fill in the blanks. But
there you go.
I remember that was the commercial though for the Wiz was nobody beats a whiz. Nobody beats a whiz.
It's so funny.
I had a lot of love for the Wiz. Nobody beats a Wiz. Enjoyed that electronic store.
Yeah.
Greatly. Greatly.
Yeah.
I miss it. Poor one. I know you said it's still around, but for me, poor one out.
Not in the same way at all.
No.
But yeah. So
what are you going to do?
So, okay. So you're going to kind of do a recut. I think that there is a world in which another Mallrats makes sense, but not with the same characters or the same families of these characters. I feel like we've checked in a lot with these characters already in the Viewisk universe. We've seen Brody's secret stash in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. You know, that was kind of like the check-in with everybody and like, hey, here's what everybody's doing at these stages and stuff. Minus TS. I don't think that anybody really cares about what TS is doing. And we don't see what Renee is doing. We have Shannon Doherty in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, but she's playing herself. Anyway, I do think that it would be a great opportunity to do a movie about mall culture as it stands today. And where it's like, yes, there are some malls that are at low capacity and are struggling in, you know, this internet culture. But I just read an article today that a nearby mall, the Washington Square Mall in Beaverton, Oregon, is at 100% capacity. And I think that's kind of amazing. And okay. In that mall, it's like, you know, there's a lot of like outdoor aspects to it, which in Oregon, it surprises me would work as well as it does. But and that one has a movie theater, and there's like bigger eateries. Inside like the indoor part of the mall, there's definitely food courts and stuff like that. But I feel like it should be more about like perhaps two nearby malls and how one of them is failing or maybe is kind of like this alt mall, and that one of them is kind of like the real chain shoppy mall that you're kind of used to. And thinking about here in Portland, like the Lloyd Center, and how it's kind of getting this surge of popularity because of these like pop-ups, I kind of do see a fun story that could happen between, like, you know, the struggling mall finding its own identity with the like the mall rat community kind of coming together and kind of turning their backs on the like, you know, functional shopper experience that's at kind of a more established 100% capacity mall. So I don't know, like
kind of like the dirt mall versus the regular mall. Yeah.
And the Eden Prairie Mall, where they filmed it, was at low capacity, which is why they could film there and they could set up all of their operations there, because Mall of America had just opened a few miles away and took all the business out of there.
Right. Yes. Had a roller coaster. And the very first episode of WCW Nitro was broadcast from the
Mall. Is that true? America.
Yes. While we're on the topic of malls, before we depart the mall and New Jersey, if the Cookie Stand is not located with the other eateries, is it part of the food court?
No,
absolutely not. Okay, good.
It's the same way that like a Wetzel's Pretzels or Cinnabon is, you know, it's there mid-mall for when snacking. You need a mid-mall snacking. There you go.
As Brody puts it. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to thank everybody on social media who voted for Mallrats to be our New Jersey pick. And I wanted to give a shout out to the movies Garden State and The Toxic Avenger for being, you know, kind of trailing behind a little bit.
Solid Jersey contenders.
I'm really excited to see The Toxic Avenger, the one that is with Peter Dinklage that premiered at Fantastic Fest, and hopefully we'll see that sometime soon. Mm-hmm. I watched Garden State again just to revisit this movie that like had such a hold on me when I was in college. Another movie that falls victim to using the R word very liberally and was not comfortable with that.
Yeah. I haven't watched Garden State in a while, but again, I was very enamored. Garden State partially filmed in our hometown.
Yeah.
I was very much into Garden State when it first came out.
Oh, I saw it so many times in the theater.
Oh, yeah. I saw it once in the theater, but it was still like I was really into it. Thought it was great. And I haven't gone back to it.
I somehow got a lot of like free passes to like advanced screenings.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like I don't remember exactly how that happened.
Were you living in Philly at that time?
I was in Philly at the time. It was the kind of movie where it was just like I was in film school at the time and it was just like, oh, this movie, it speaks to me and blah, 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 blah.
Yes.
And like, you know,
yes.
And now I see it. I'm just like, man, I'm embarrassed because, you know, as time went on, it like played into so many cliches about itself and like this song will change your life. And, you know,
right.
The Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
Yeah. I mean, it's very, you know, early 2000s.
Totally.
Fits very, very nicely in there. But yeah, like I said, I've not gone back to that movie. And in terms of representing New Jersey, I feel like the, you know, and of course the quintessential diner movie is set in Baltimore. So.
Right. Yeah, I know.
You've got that and you've got the mall culture of New Jersey. And there's so many other great ones that are set in New Jersey that I really like about what they kind of represent about the state. Like Copland, the idea of New Jersey being kind of like the place where like it's the New York power players go to sleep.
So I watched Copland for the first time after we had talked about like internal affairs movies on a previous episode. And I loved it. I thought it was awesome. And I like it when Stallone is playing against type.
Yeah.
And is doing something interesting.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it's like he's partially deaf. He's not in Stallone shape. He's not showing off, you know, his physical prowess. He's being like an introspective, interesting person, which is kind of like, you know, even though, yes, he's showing off his physical prowess, but in the first Rocky, it's like also showing off how he can be like a deep intellectual character, you know, kind of trapped. And, you know, it's like showing off good acting chops. And the story itself is compelling. Yeah, it's, you know, it's the small town in New Jersey that's just on the other side of the river. And it's where all the dirty New York cops live and they are protected. And I think that I read that because of that movie, it's now like mandatory that New York cops have to live in New York or something like that. Like,
yeah, I think I saw that as well.
Yeah. Which is so fascinating, but, great movie.
Great Jersey movie. Yeah. There are of course so many others, but it felt right to talk about a Kevin Smith movie, a filmmaker who really has tied his like New Jersey is part of his identity.
Yeah.
As a filmmaker, and no matter how many times he's tried to like stray away from that, it's what he comes back to.
So, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, Jersey is one of those, it's one of those states that I feel like, you know, like it's got a reputation, but it just feels really real to me to be able to, you know, say like, you know, that's where I'm from. That's where that's where I grew up. And it feels like it carries some weight. It holds some weight. And I may or may not have earned the right to use that and throw that around. But it is something that I'm proud of. And like little anecdote to, you know, to wrap it up with here. So recently my daughter Chloe, who's 10, was in the car with me, and she normally just shuns any music that I put on, but she happened, I just like kind of hit shuffle on a playlist, and the first song to play was the 10,000 Maniacs unplugged version of Because the Night. And halfway into the song, Chloe's like, this is my favorite song. This is my new favorite song. I love the piano and I love this. And like, I love this song. Can we listen to it again and again and again? So I told her, I said, you know who wrote that song? It's Bruce Springsteen. Mm-hmm. And he's from Jersey.
Yeah.
Just like me. And I told her, I said, you might have been born in New York and you might have grown up mostly in Seattle, but you have Jersey blood.
Yeah. Absolutely. So
it runs deep.
Much like the Rahway River runs through our hometown of Cranford, New Jersey.
But Jersey blood runs deeper than the Rahway River. It's not a deep river. Not a deep river. The Raritan, perhaps. Yes, on the banks of the old Raritan.
Well, Dan, enough about New Jersey. Let's talk about New Mexico for our next episode.
Oh, yeah, man. Wow. Yeah. Talk about travel here. We are going to New Mexico and we are going to be checking out a classic, a New Mexico set classic starring Gary Cooper and Grace Kelly, directed by Fred Zinnemann. It is High Noon from 1952. I don't have the year written down in front of me, but I feel like I'm feeling confident.
That feels right.
High Noon. Yeah.
Lloyd Bridges.
Lee Van Cleef.
Yeah. Is it
right? Yeah. Lee Van Cleef. So we've got a classic Western to take us into the New Mexico territory here, as New Mexico was not a state when High Noon is set.
But set. Yeah.
It's a state now. And because Breaking Bad is a TV show and not a movie.
El Camino is a movie, but
it's fine. No, High Noon is a classic. It's a Western. So we're going there. Gary Cooper, super duper. I can't wait.
Fantastic. Well, Dan, as you are, I don't know, headed off to the mall. I wish you a good journey.
I'm going to be heading down the parkway to exit 130. To the mall.
Fair enough.
Good journey.
Not the turnpike, the parkway. Good journey.